Everyone, and a very warm welcome. I think we look forward to the study weekends. Thank you to the committee who have organised this, Mike, who has done the lion's share of the administrative work, and Cedric for coming to be our speaker. Now, it falls upon me to introduce Cedric, although I'm very well aware that most of you either know him already or met him last week because he was our speaker at the Scottish Mission Day of Fellowship over in Dunfermline, and we were truly blessed. Now, at that time, because we were overrunning, I didn't give a formal introduction. Cedric sort of introduced himself. I was so conscious of the time at that occasion. But now I can actually introduce Cedric. You see, I've known Cedric for many years as a young man growing up in the British Union in my former incarnation as a youth director for the church. Cedric was one of the Bradford Pathfinders many years back, and a very good Pathfinder club they were too. I believe I sent Cedric out on a student missionary duty, and you served for 2 years in Poland, if I'm right. And that would be in the 1990s. Well, there we go. Oh, that dates both of us, Cedric. Now, to give Cedric his full title, he's Dr. Cedric Vine, or it could be Dr. Pastor Cedric Vine, or is it Pastor Dr. Cedric Vine? But it is Cedric to most people. He comes to us from Andrews University, where he is there as a professor of New Testament at the seminary. Before then, he served for 8 years, I think eight anyway, at Newbold, and he was a much loved teacher, and it was a great loss to Newbold when Cedric was called over to Andrews. But I have a sneaking suspicion one day we will get him back, but we will see if I'm a prophet or not. Cedric is British. You will know his family. The Vine family are a well-known Adventist family. Dad, Robert, and Uncle Richard, pastors. Also his granddad, Ray, and there may even be more, for all I know, further in the history. His brother, Conrad, also a pastor. And so it is a family of note within the church. I think, Cedric, when you graduated from Newbold, you started your internship at Camp Hill Church for a couple of years, and then you must have served as an intern and a minister in the North England Conference. I think Derby may have been one of your last, yes. So Cedric, actually, although only a young man, has served already probably 20 years for the church, and he comes with a wealth of knowledge. To sit and listen to Cedric is truly a treat. And I don't need to say any more, Cedric, other than you are truly welcome. You've been to Crieff before because I believe about 6 or 7 years ago you came and did a study series on the Book of Mark. But this weekend is going to be on the Book of Matthew. And tonight's session is The Loud Cry, The Necessity of Different Christian Identities in the End Times. The slips for everybody. We will introduce tomorrow's programmes and then Sunday's at the end. Enough from me. Cedric, you truly are welcome. You are among friends. You're not a stranger. You're not somebody who's just come from outside. You're truly a friend and a pilgrim. God bless you.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Paul. So, Steve, I can put this down. Yeah, good evening, everyone, and happy Sabbath, and it really is a pleasure to be with you. And I hope you don't mind, but this evening I'm in my teacher mode, so it's what I get paid to do, and it's what I feel most natural doing, which is why I haven't got a tie on, because I am proudly the worst dressed professor in the New Testament department at the seminary. But anyway, just to give you a bit of a bit more background. Why Matthew? Matthew is what I did my doctorate on, and I did that at the University of Sheffield. And why I did it on Matthew is because when I was pastoring in Derby, I was doing studies with essentially secular people. And, you know, the traditional Bible studies tend to assume a degree of biblical knowledge. And what I found was that I had to go right back to basics and give them a Bible study on who Jesus was, the Gospels, before I sort of moved on to other things. So I did a series in the Derby churches on the Gospel of Matthew. And then when I went to Sheffield, my first year was on the Gospel of John. And then my supervisor was away. When she came back, she took what I had written. She saw a waste paper bin in the corner, and she unceremoniously threw my work in the bin. And she said, "Cedric, we need to start from scratch." And that was a lesson, because the previous supervisor, everything I wrote for him was great, and that's the worst type of supervisor you can get. Yeah, you really want someone who can make you feel uncomfortable. So she got me onto a different subject, and at that time I was thinking, if I'm going to do it on one of the Gospels, why don't I do it on what I've just been sharing in the church? So Matthew was sort of at my fingertips. So that's really how I got into Matthew. Since I've moved to the seminary, I've been working on a project which is, I'd say it's almost complete. It's a book. My dissertation was really like a young upstart chap going into a pottery shop and just smashing everything up. I was going along to, and it was my supervisor who got me into this, but really I was deconstructing one scholarly approach to the Gospel of Matthew. But it's one thing to know what the scholars say, and it's another thing to know what the biblical text says. And so really for the last 4 years since I went to Andrews, I've been doing a lot of study on Matthew, really from looking at the theology of it. I've been writing a book. It's almost turned into the length of a second PhD. And it's virtually finished. But it's really been an attempt to get my head around one single verse or a couple of verses at the very end of Matthew, which is, if I can get this working, let's see. It's the Gospel Commission. And as Adventists, this is very, very important for us as our identity, shaping our identity. Where I work at the seminary, when you walk into the main entrance, we've got two verses, one from Revelation 14 and the other from Matthew 28. Go ye therefore and make disciples. So as I walk to work every day, I look at these and think, what am I meant to be doing? What am I preparing pastors for doing? So I've done the right-hand verse, and that's really what I'm going to share with you. What does it mean to make disciples? And so often when we read these verses, we take them out of context, out of their literary context, and then we fill it with whatever the latest fad is in ministry. And so what I'm going to do is try and give you the background in the Gospel of Matthew for what this Gospel Commission is all about. What does it mean to go ye therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you? And remember, I'll be with you always to the end of the age. So that's my goal, is really to put this into context. And that's what I've spent 4 years doing, studying this. So what I would like for you... a sheet, you may have a sheet, which really is just for you to sort of do some scribbles. You can do some nice, pretty pictures on it. I was just teaching in Canada 2 weeks ago, 8 hours a day for a week. Now, I came back pretty exhausted, but I thought, after 8 hours a day, a couple of hours in Crieff is a walk in the park. Yeah, you could sort of... so anyway... what I'm going to do this evening is to give you an overview of the Gospel of Matthew. I'm going to run through it a couple of times and just show you sort of how the evangelist orders his material and what are the main themes. And that will really set the context for what we're going to do in coming sessions. And what I would invite you to, if you've got a question, please raise your hand and please feel free to ask questions. Yeah, this is teaching context, so So if you've got something, that you'd like to raise, please feel free to do that. Okay? So let me start, and if you don't mind, I'm going to use the board and my pen, and we may be able to leave this, once we've done the fancy artwork, for the whole 3 days together. And what we notice when we're reading the Gospel of Matthew, this is really the main theory that has dominated Matthew. What is, if you were asked, what is an overview of Matthew? This would be the overview that would have been given you up until the 1970s. Okay? And it goes something like this. We've got chapters 5 to 7. We've got next one is chapter 10, chapter 13, chapter 18, chapters 24 to 25. Now, how many sections have we got there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5. And let me show you why scholars identify these as 5 sections. If you've got your Bibles, you really do need your Bibles. So, this is, what do we call chapters 5 to 7? Sermon on the Mount. It includes the Beatitudes. So, it's the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, and if we look at verse 28, we have a little phrase which we will see pops up again and again as we go through the Gospel of Matthew. And in Greek, it really is the same as you go through each of these 5 sections. So, reading verse 28, chapter 7. Now, when Jesus had done what? Finished saying these things. The crowds were astounded at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. So there we have, almost like a full stop. He's saying, this is the end. Now let's go to chapter 10. And there he's teaching about, we can call that witnessing. Okay? And all of that is about witnessing. So these are your values that you are to live by. But you're not to keep them to yourself. You've got to go and share them with others. And if you come to chapter 11, verse 1, which is really the end of chapter 10, chapter 11, verse 1, we have a similar phrase to what we've just seen. Now, when Jesus had, what do your versions say? Finished instructing his 12 disciples. Now, you would expect at that point that the 12 disciples, having been taught what to do, what do you think they should do? They should go out and do the witnessing bit. But in reality, they don't. The one who goes and does these actions is Jesus. Yeah? So we find that actually, the disciples at this point, they're not very good. Yeah? And although he's instructed them, they don't actually do what they're told to do. Then we come to chapter 13. And here we have 7 parables. Yeah. And at the moment I'm trying to work out what I should, you know, I've got a couple of sermons, but tomorrow I'm wondering for my sermon whether I should shift to the 7 parables. They're a beautiful section of the gospel. And Jesus shares 7 parables, and then we come to verse 53. I'm just going to put 53 there. 53, and we read a similar thing. When Jesus had, what do your versions have?
Finished.
These parables, they left that place. And then we move on to chapter 18. And these are for use for when you're witnessing. Chapter 18 is hopefully people are actually responding and coming together and forming a community. And so chapter 18 is all the values of what it means to rub along together. Yeah? And it's a very, very realistic chapter. Yeah? We've got the little ones and the awkward squad. Yeah? Those are the two groups in chapter 18. Yeah? Don't despise the little ones, and with the awkward squad, give them a second chance. That's basically chapter 18. And it's how to survive in community. Now we go to chapter 19, verse 1. Yeah? And what's our word we've got there, which we've had 3 times. You get the idea? What have we got? when Jesus had finished saying these things. He left Galilee and went on to the region of Judea. Now we go to chapter 24 and 25. You'll know this is all about the future. And if we go, you'll notice it's the signs of the times and the end. And then we come to chapter 26, verse 1. And you got your favorite word by now. What did Jesus do? He finished saying all these things. So here we have, through a literary technique, it's the technique of repetition. He's simply telling us, I want you to think of these as distinct units. Now, we've got five. Why are five teaching sections important? What is the evangelist trying to tell us about Jesus? Especially when here, where does Jesus share these things from? It's not a very good artwork, but yeah, where is he preaching from? A mountain. So what he's really telling us is that there was another person who went up a mountain and then taught us five blocks of teachings, and his name is Moses. So he's telling us that Jesus is a new Moses. Now, actually, I am fairly convinced of this, and I think this is in the text. If you want a scholarly treatment of it, there was an American guy with a Welsh chap, Davies and Allison. Allison is the American, the young guy, and W.D. Davies was Welsh Presbyterian but moved to America. And they wrote three volumes. Mike has it on his bookshelf. So, you know, if you need to see a copy, go and talk to Mike. He's got a fantastic biblical library there at home, lurking in Creef. But Allison, who is the American in this joint venture with the commentary, he wrote a fairly large book entitled The New Moses, simply exploring this thesis. And it's been around for a long time. There's variations on it. Some people have knocked it. But what I've just shown you would indicate that actually I think there is a point that he is. Now, we find more teachings. You know, you can look in the chapters here and you can find other teachings of Jesus. But he's purposefully gathered material which in Mark is spread out or in Luke is spread out, and he's thematically clumped it together. It's why it's very easy to remember the chapters in Matthew, far easier than Luke. Yeah, because he's taken stuff in Luke, which is all over the place, sermon on the plain plus a bit extra, and he's gathered it together into units. Okay, so there is our first point. Jesus is the new Moses. So there's one way of looking at the Gospel of Matthew. Now, there's another way of looking at the Gospel of Matthew, which orders it a little differently. And this was suggested, I mean, it's there in the text, but highlighted by an American scholar called Kingsbury. And let me show you this. Let's go to chapter 4, verse 17. So, 4:17. Okay, and this verse is another way of cutting up the gospel into different units. 4, verse 17. And it says, from that time, Jesus began to proclaim, repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. So, from chapter 4 on, what is he doing? What's Jesus doing? According to that verse. He's preaching. Yeah, so he's preaching. Now we go to chapter 16. Verse 21. And we find a shift in gear in the gospel. Everything changes. So, chapter 16, verse 21. From that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. What do we have in common? What words were in common between this verse and this verse? From that time. Yeah. And what is he doing in this one? He's explaining and teaching them, and in particular, teaching them what? His death and resurrection. So now we are moving death and resurrection. Okay. So what we can do, we can start investigating this. This is definitely there. The question is really as to whether this is the main point of the gospel. We've also got other shifts going on. And what I want to do is just to spend a few moments thinking and just expounding this. Because what we find, if I draw a line sort of down here, and I'm going to draw a line there, and I know I've got my lines, that should be moved over a bit. But what we find is that in this section, Jesus, geographically, where is he mostly? Where does he spend most of his time?
Galilee.
And in this section, where is he mostly? Jerusalem. Okay. Now, if we go to chapter 10, we find that Jesus, and here he is, he's explaining his disciples what he's doing. He's multiplying his own ministry. Yeah. He's telling us who his audience are in this section. Matthew chapter 10, and we read in verse 5, really to verse 6. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Go nowhere among the Gentiles, and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to, who are they to go to? Here's their audience. To the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven has come near. So according to that verse, Jesus doesn't want them to go to the Gentiles, doesn't even want them to go to their near cousins, the Samaritans, but instead, I only want you to go to one group, and that is the lost sheep. Of which house? Israel. So here we can put that it is to the sheep. Now, if you've got sheep, what do you often get with them?
Shepherds.
Okay, we often get shepherds. And really what we've got going on here is an allusion to Ezekiel 34, and you can go on in those chapters. But there it talks about Israel as being sheep and shepherds. And what are the shepherds like? Do they look after the sheep? No, they abuse them, they kill them, and they turn them into lamb stew and use them for their own ends. Yes, and those are the shepherds of Israel. And the promise is that one day Yahweh will come back, and he, in Ezekiel, will be the shepherd of Israel, and he will use a son of David to be a good shepherd. So we've got all of that imagery sort of bumbling along in the background. So here he's going to the sheep. Now, when Jesus meets with people in this section of the gospel, yeah, he's no longer meeting with your average Joes, yeah, but who is he meeting in the second half of the gospel? The leaders, the chief priests, the elders, the scribes, the Pharisees. The Pharisees are a debatable one. They're actually commoners, yeah, but certainly Sadducees. So here he's really dealing with the shepherds. Now, they are still of one nation. Yeah. So really what we're doing, we're looking at sort of the underlings and the overlings, the sheep and the shepherds. And that allows us to look at this and think, okay, Jesus is coming to Israel and he's hitting all the different groups. He's got a message for the different groups that are in Israel, both for the sheep and for the shepherds. Okay. Now, the shepherds here that we meet, they're still of the same house. Ultimately, we're dealing with which house here? Israel. Okay. So this is really the story of Jesus coming to Israel. Now, you know this because back in chapter 1, we're told that you're going to name him Jesus, because what is he going to do?
Save his people from their sins.
He's going to save his people from their sins. Now, who are his people? Israel. So this is not the book of Romans, letter of Romans, which is talking about Jesus coming to save the world. But this is Jesus coming to deal with Israel. Now you read that and you think, well, I ain't no Israelite. So what does it have to do with me? Well, here's one thing. It tells us that Jesus doesn't give up on his people even when they're deep in sin. I like that lesson. Is that he comes and he tries his very, very best with Israel to turn Israel around. Okay? Here is another reason why we need to take this story seriously, is because when we come to chapter 8, now if we might say there is one mission here to the sheep, there's a second mission to the shepherds, they're all part of Israel, but then we come in chapter 28, and now the disciples are told to go to the nations. And when you go to the nations, teach them all things that I have commanded you. Now, where has he been doing all his commanding? With Israel. So the logic of the gospel is this. As Jesus comes to Israel and ministers to Israel, he wants us to do the same to the nations. That's really the logic of the gospel. It's telling us what Jesus does to Israel provides a template for what we are to do when we go to the nations. Okay? That's really why, when John wrote, or Matthew wrote his gospel, he knew what the ending would be. Nobody in the ancient world wrote papers like we write them, you know, students. Yeah, they write their introduction and then they think, oh, okay, I'll put a few points down, but how am I going to end this thing? Yeah, they always knew the end. And Matthew knows what his end is that there is a mission to the nations, and that this provides the template for us going to the nations. Okay, now, in my title for this series, we've got Last Generation, and you may know that in Adventism there is a thing that lurks around in various places called Last Generation Theology. Have you heard that? Well, let me show you where Last Generation Theology is in Matthew, okay? And it really gives us, a good understanding that generations do count. Generations do count. So let's go to the very beginning of the gospel. And I'm going to talk for five, 10 minutes on this. We are going through, Mike, to 8:30 today, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Got the jitters there, thinking it was 8 o'clock. So Matthew chapter 1, and if you've read Matthew, you will know that this is probably your favourite part of the gospel. Yeah. It's a favourite part. We've got a list. Well, actually, let me just show you something. Yeah, an account of the genealogy of Matthew. Let me just skip out. I don't know why, but okay, there we go. Let me skip to Matthew... Matthew 1, and I don't know whether you can see this, but in the Greek it says an account of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the Christ, the son of David, and the son of Abraham. And the bit I want you to, now I'm not expecting you to read Greek this evening, but certainly by Sunday I'm expecting it. Yeah. But here's one word in Greek, yeah, which is worth knowing in Matthew. So, biblos. We can guess what that word is. Book. G-e-n-e-s-e-o-s. Geneseus. Now, what English word does that sound like? Genesis. Okay. So, you know, really, this is the book of Genesis of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. And we've got to read it in light of all this. So, the whole thing. Now, what does that remind you of, the book of Genesis? It reminds you of the book of Genesis. Yes, and the book of Genesis talks about, we have the Toledot there, we have the list of the, you know, the sons of Adam, the sons of Abraham. Yes, it's really a family history. And this is what he's doing. He's giving us a family history. That's what we get at the beginning. So really, just like we're very used to the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and we think straight away about Genesis. Matthew is doing the same thing. He wants us to understand that whatever's happening is a new start with the world. Okay, it is a Genesis that is occurring here. And we're not going to read it, but if you can trust me with the names, you'll know. So we've got 14 generations, and we go up from Abraham through to David. We've actually got a nice summary right at the end, verse 17. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14. So we're starting off with little Israel. We get to the maximum up to David, but then we come crashing down to the deportation, and now really we're bumbling along the bottom. So we've got 14, 14, and another 14. Now you might ask why 14. Numerically, it's the name of David. Okay, but I don't know how much weight to put on that. It's very hard when you start working out numerical values of names, but some scholars suggest that. But here's the thing. You know, what it's telling us is that historically, if we compare this with Luke's genealogy is about 300 or 400 years longer. Okay, so Matthew has just missed out huge sections from Israel's history. So what he's really doing, he's giving us a theological history. He's saying God established Israel, and then what did Israel do? Very unfaithful, took them into exile. But then he brought them back. And you know, really, it's this last 14 which we end up scratching our head thinking, well, is Israel improving or Israel going down the drain? What's going on with Israel? And the answer is very easy to find. Yeah, if we, let's see, there we go. Ooh. If we do, you can do this in Greek or English. Let me get rid of that. So this is the word genea, generations we get. So it is more in Matthew than in any other New Testament book. And as you start reading through, you find out that it's one of Jesus's favorite words. Yeah, this generation. It's all the way through. What will I compare this generation? It is like a children sitting in the marketplace calling to one another. And you can never keep these children happy in chapter 11. Chapter 12, an evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but you're not going to get it. Chapter 12, 41, the people of Nineveh will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it. The queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation. So it will be also with this evil generation. Chapter 16, an evil and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given it. Chapter 17, you faithless and perverse generation. And that actually includes the 12. Okay. So gradually we sort of, you know, for the less perceptible reader, by this point you're getting in the gospel and hopefully you've worked out what the state is of this generation that Jesus comes to. What's their state? Faithless, evil, adulterous. Spiritually, what does it mean to be adulterous? In the Old Testament, when Israel was adulterous, what was she doing? False gods. And what we will see as we go through Matthew is that the problem with Israel is not legalism. It's out-and-out apostasy. They are following other gods, an adulterous and evil generation. If legalism was their problem, the solution would be ease up, mate, a little, and we can get back on the right track. But we need a far bigger solution because the problem is more serious. It's an adulterous generation. And this goes all the way through. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass until all these things. So here we've got generations, and all the way through, it's an evil generation. Okay, and we go on and we go on until we get to chapter 18. Let's go to, actually, chapter 17. Let's go to chapter 17. No, chapter 18. Let's start with chapter 18. And if we can read chapter 18, verses 1 to 5. Let me read these. And I want you to tell me what's going on with the generations in this passage. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a child whom he put among them and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." So here we have children, 18:1-2. Let's flip over to chapter 19, verse 13. Yeah, and, you know, I've used this as a pastor so many times when we do baby dedications. But actually, it's a really serious text, this. Yeah, chapter 19, verse 13. "Then little children were being brought to him in order that he might lay his hands on them and pray. The disciples spoke sternly to those who brought them. But Jesus said, 'Let the little children come to me and do not stop them, for it is to such as these that the kingdom of heaven belongs.' And he laid his hands on them and went on his way." So again, what have we got? 19 verse 13. And we can jump over to chapter 21. And this is when Jesus is now coming into the temple. And you remember the story when he comes in and the kids are praising. It's the children. We read this in, this is verse 15. "But when the chief priests and the scribes saw the amazing things he did and heard the children crying out in the temple, 'Hosanna to the Son of David,' they became angry and said to him, 'Do you hear what they are saying?' And Jesus said to him, 'Yes, have you never read?'" I mean, it's rather ironic. These guys spent most of the day reading. "Yeah, but have you ever read? 'Out of the mouths of infants and nursing babies, you've prepared praise for yourself.'" So that's chapter 21. Say verse 15. Now, in light of the fact that we've got an evil generation, what does the theme of children, how does it relate to the evil generation theme? It's the next generation. So he's looking with hope and he's saying, maybe there will be a new generation. Now, not everybody is a child and not everybody is an adult. Now, we can go back to chapter 19. And we've got the story of a rich man who comes to Jesus in verse 16. Teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? And he said to him, why do you ask me about what is good? There is only one who is good. If you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments. And he said, which ones? And you remember how Jesus went through. And in verse 20, how is he described in verse 20? Young man. The young man said to him, I have kept all these. What do I still lack? Jesus said to him, if you wish to be complete or perfect, go sell your possessions, give the money to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven. Then come, follow me. When the, and he's described again, the young man, neaniskoi, it means he's between 21 and 28. The ancients, they segmented your life into 7-year periods, up to 7, 14, 21, 28. They had a name for each period. So from the Greek, you can tell how old he is, from the word that's used. So he's between 21 and 28. Okay. When the young man heard this word, he went away grieving, for he had many possessions. So there we've got chapter 19, verse 20. So what have we got? We've got, now, does this guy accept? Where is he? Do you think he's part of the evil generation? He's questioning, isn't he? He comes to Jesus, and what was his question? What must I do to have eternal life? Maybe better is life of the new age. Yeah, that's probably a better translation. What must I do? That doesn't sound like somebody who's part of the evil generation. But does he make it into the kingdom? No. What's holding him back? Possessions. Yeah, and as we go through tomorrow morning in Sabbath school, we will see that actually Matthew is portraying Israel as serving another master. And in the Old Testament, when you serve another master, that is adulterous behavior, spiritually adulterous behavior. So we can see really what he's doing. He's giving us the generations. He wants us to start thinking in generations. Okay? And he's always asking us to compare this generation with earlier generations. If I can just add something here. Tomorrow afternoon, and really we'll be going through in more detail what I shared last week at the Day of Fellowship, but there with Jerusalem, he compares them, Jerusalem, to the generation of Sodom. Okay? A city compared with a city. When you judge all the nations, when Jesus comes back to judge the nations, it will be as in the days of Noah. The generation of Noah. What were they doing? They were just going through life, oblivious of really the time that it was. And so this is what you find is that Matthew, this is typical Jewish approach, is that the Jews, I mean, you can read it in your Old Testament, there were particular evil generations through time. There was the wilderness generation, who apostatized in the wilderness. There was the flood generation, Noah's generation, Sodom and Gomorrah. There were particular generations who the Lord looked at and thought, oh my, how can I handle this generation? Okay, they've just got so wicked that I've got to do something about this. Yeah. And this is really the context for what I would suggest, what I've termed as the loud cry. Now, I've just, copy and pasted that from Sister White. Yes, because being at the seminary, I've always got to show my Wave the flag, yes. I'm not going to dig myself into a deeper hole, but I want to situate what I've done, you know, within our Adventist teaching and maybe just move us along a little. Let's move on and look at some of the stories, how they hang together, and what the Lord is doing for this generation, now that we've seen his this theme, how it works through. So, what I would like to do is for us to go to two texts, and these texts are going to be crucial for, they really set the agenda for the rest of our presentations. And the first one is in chapter 10 and verses 40 to 42. Okay, we read this at our day of fellowship last week. So, chapter 10, verse 40 and 40 to 42. Whoever welcomes you, welcomes me. Whoever welcomes me, welcomes the one who sent me. This is envoy theology. It means that the Father in heaven may not come into your house, but I am coming into your house. That's Jesus saying that. But if it's not me who comes into your house, then it's one of my followers. But when one of my followers comes into your house, who is really coming in? Me. And not the one who sent me, not just me, but the one who sent me. And this is an incredible statement. Yeah, I think about this all the time. Yeah, because tomorrow we will see that basically we live, if you live in a nation with an evil generation, God is effectively absent from your nation. But he's present in the presence of his envoys. Okay, we'll see that tomorrow morning. That we may actually be living in an environment, in a nation, where God has actually stepped out. So if you're an atheist, you look around and say, there's no evidence for God. And I say, yes, there isn't. You're right. You're absolutely right. God has stepped outside of you, out of your world. Yeah. That, I'll share that with you tomorrow morning. But that idea has just helped me make sense, yeah, of effectively the Western Christian experience, why it is at such variance to what other Christians experience around the world. But the evidence is, okay, you know, you haven't ever experienced God. Well, I'm the evidence for God. And you just think, well, you know, the importance of the disciple in this situation. So that's the opening verse. Let's read on. Whoever welcomes, what's our first job description here? Whoever welcomes a prophet. Okay, whoever welcomes a prophet in the name of a prophet, that just means as a prophet. So they're not just welcoming you just as any guy off the street, but because you're a prophet, I welcome you as a prophet. Will receive a prophet's reward. And whoever welcomes a righteous person. In the name of a righteous person, so as a righteous person, will receive the reward of the righteous. And whoever gives even a cup of cold water to one of these little ones in the name of a disciple, truly, I tell you, none of these will lose their rewards. So there we have disciple. Okay. So here we have three roles. Now, you know, you read, you know your Old Testament. You know that these roles are embedded within Old Testament theology. You find it in the prophets. You find it throughout the Old Testament. And really, that's what we've got to understand. When Jesus is saying to Israel, sending the disciples, I'm sending you out, and I want you to be this, going out to the sheep, yeah, they must have had some understanding of what these roles were. But we also have some more roles. Chapter 23, verse 34. Okay, so we're not done with our roles. Okay, chapter 23, verse 34. And there we read, And here Jesus is talking to the shepherds, to the scribes and Pharisees who sit on Moses' seat. Chapter 23, verse 34. Therefore, I send you. Now, let me read the verse before. I like this verse. You snakes, you brood of vipers, how can you escape being sentenced to Gehenna or to hell? Therefore, I send you prophets, sages, or does anybody else have a different translation to that? Wise men. And that's the one we're going to use. Wise men and scribes, some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some of whom you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. So here we've got three groups: prophets, wise men, and scribes. Okay, now who's going to send them? Not trick question. I. Who is I there? Jesus. So let's just put that in dummies language, but this is very, very important. Who is going to send the prophets? Jesus sends prophets. Now, in the Old Testament, who sends prophets? God. So what we find in the gospel is that Jesus is always doing things that in the Old Testament only God does. Okay, now that tells you a lot. Essentially tells you that he is, that's really what it's telling us. Yeah, they're speaking one and the same thing. I had a lovely idea this morning, walking the paths of St. Mary's, whatever it is. Yeah, you know the Lord's Prayer? Our Father in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Well, actually, whose name is hallowed throughout the gospel? Name of Jesus. Thy kingdom come. Who proclaims the kingdom? Jesus. Thy will be done. He expects us to follow his will. Give us this day our daily bread. What is Jesus doing? Feeding the 5,000, giving us our daily bread. Yeah. Forgive us our sins. Who forgives sins in the gospel? Jesus. Yeah. You find that actually he defines God, and then he does everything that he defines this God to do. Okay. So, anyway, that's just a little aside. I got a bit excited about that. I can show you where I had that revelation. It's another sermon, isn't it? Yeah. So, I took a picture where I had that insight, that vision. But anyway, here we've got 5 roles. Prophets, righteous persons, disciples, wise men, scribes. Now, that really is our agenda for the rest of our weekend. What does it mean to be a prophet? What does it mean to be a righteous person, a disciple, or we could say a student? Now, a disciple, we think of it in religious terms, but really a disciple is someone into education. It's an educator who is also being educated, a wise man and scribes. So there we have 5 roles. Now, before we come back to those, there's one role which the followers of Jesus in Matthew are not expected to undertake yet, whereas in Luke, they are. They're given a role, but not in the Gospel of Matthew. If we went back to chapter 1, the first description of Jesus, what was he? Sure.
Your thing says scribes. Mine says teacher. I thought a scribe just wrote down what somebody else told them to write, whereas a teacher is a different role.
Scribes were teachers.
Were they?
Yes, yeah. And our problem is that these all overlap pretty much. Yeah. So I've had this headache of trying to go through the gospel and work out how to unpick these. What's the theology of the prophet? What does a prophet do? What does a disciple do? A disciple learns but also teaches. Wise men teach, scribes teach, prophets also teach. There's a lot of overlap between them. Yeah? The word is grammatois. Okay? Grammar. We get the word grammar from it. It's just somebody into letters. And our problem is that's the hardest one to define, scribes. As we will go through, is Jesus a prophet? Yes. Is Jesus a righteous person? You heard it in the sermon last week. He dies as one who is righteous. Is he a disciple of his father? But he's also teacher. And Matthew purposefully doesn't use the word rabbi with Jesus. He uses the word didaskalos. Okay, so if you read Mark and Luke, Jesus is rabbi. The only folk who call Jesus rabbi are people like Judas when he kisses Jesus. Rabbi. Yeah. But those who come to him with faith call him didaskalos. Yeah, he's teacher. Is Jesus a wise man? Yes. In fact, he's more than a wise man. He's wisdom herself, which in the Old Testament is part of Yahweh. So he's a wise man. Is he a scribe? That's the hardest one to answer that question. Is he a scribe? What did we just say he is? New Moses. He's more than a scribe. He's actually a lawgiver himself. Okay? But scribes are the ones who interpret this. Okay? So, we've got all these groups, and who is he sending them to? To Israel. Why is he doing this? Because he wants to turn Israel around. And in fact, there's one other title which we haven't emphasized. In Luke, you are one of these. I don't remember in Mark, but in Matthew, not until Jesus comes will you receive this. What are you going to receive when Jesus comes?
A crown.
You're going to become kings and queens. I have great pleasure in America telling them that Christianity is not the Christian nation is not a republic, it's a monarchy. Now, you don't know how much pleasure I get out of that. Yes. You know, and they go on about these, the kings who tell them what to do, and they don't like that. And I say, oh, let me introduce you to a king who tells you what to do. Jesus Christ. Anyway, so here we've got King Jesus. Okay? There is only one king in town. And essentially, the story of Matthew is of Jesus the king coming back to his nation. And what do they do to him? They kill their king. Okay? Now, this is a special king. So, we have two very, very important moments. And let's see where we can draw this. I'm going to erase this. And I'm going to draw. So, here you've got Galilee. Let's go to chapter 3 of Matthew. And it's the story of the baptism and temptation of Jesus. So, let me read this. Verse 13, chapter 3. Then Jesus came from Galilee to John at the Jordan to be baptized by him. John would have prevented him, saying, I need to be baptized by you. Do you come to me? But Jesus answered him, let it be so now, for it is proper for us in this way to fulfill all righteousness. There's a huge amount of discussion as to what that means. Then he consented. And when Jesus had been baptized, just as he came up from the water, suddenly the heavens were opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, this is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I'm well pleased. Now, I'm going to assume you've got a certain knowledge of the story. First question, where does it occur? By the Jordan. And where is the Jordan? Look at chapter 3, verse 1. Where was John the Baptist? In the wilderness. Okay? So the wilderness is over here. This is the wilderness. This is Galilee. Yeah, and he's out in the wilderness. Does he have a problem getting everybody out for the meetings? No. They come out in their crowd, in crowds and crowds of them, thousands. Now, you know, wouldn't it be nice if that occurred today? Why doesn't it occur today? What was going on with the fact that John the Baptist could go into the wilderness and crowds would come? Okay? The reason is, and we know this from Josephus, and I can give you the, I could go through examples, but I'm not sure we have time today, is that there were lots and lots of prophets and messiahs who would go out into the wilderness and make promises. If you come out to the wilderness, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to enable the River Jordan to part. Why would you promise the crowds that you could part the River Jordan? You're a prophet. Who parted the River Jordan?
Joshua.
And when he parted the River Jordan, that was a replay of Moses and the Red Sea. If you read in the it's explicit in the Old Testament. So that itself, the Jordan, is a replay of the Red Sea. Okay? So we go into the wilderness, and I can part the river for you. Yeah? There's another prophet who went out into the wilderness. The crowds followed. If you follow me, we'll march from the wilderness to Jerusalem, and then I will make the walls fall down. What does that remind you of? Jericho. And we find that basically the Jewish mentality is, if God has done all these acts in the past, yeah, hey, maybe we can replay them. And when John the Baptist goes into the wilderness and the crowds flock to him, it's because he's chosen the site very carefully. I'm going back to the place where our nation originated. It's a replay of Old Testament history. God started Israel here, and this is what we've got. I mean, you just think of it. We've got Jesus passing through the waters. What is Jesus' name in Hebrew? Joshua. Yeah. I've had great fun reading the book of Joshua in Greek. And every time you come across the word Joshua, what name do you come across in Greek? Jesus. Yeah, and you just think, this is the story about Jesus. Yes? And here you've got this guy, and he's baptized, which is really a passing through the water, and then he's taken up into another part of the wilderness where he is tempted by Satan three times. And every time that Satan addresses him, Jesus quotes from one particular book. Deuteronomy. Yeah? Deuteronomy three times. Okay? Now, why Deuteronomy? Because it's the law for Israel as they are entering the promised land. So, really, at this beginning, chapter 3 and 4, what Jesus is doing with John, they're really, it's like when your computer is frozen. Let's just turn it back on again. That's what they're doing. Let's restart Israel. When it all kicked off, we're going back to the beginning and we're going to restart. Okay? So this is what we might call conquest imagery. Okay? And it starts off with Jesus telling Israel what they should be. Sermon on the Mount. We'll see tomorrow that we get deeds of power. It's what a prophet does. Unfortunately, they don't like what he's saying. So we end up with woes in chapter 11. And he gives them one final appeal, the seven parables, at which point here we have Exodus from Galilee. Chapters 14, say to 16. And in these chapters, Jesus has really given up on the cities of Galilee. And what you find is that Jesus is always in the district of. The district of. He's not in towns. He's avoiding the towns. Okay? So he's in the district of Tyre and Sidon, the district of Caesarea Philippi. He doesn't go into the towns. When he goes to Galilee, it says that he passed by the lake. He doesn't even go home, which is pretty amazing. It means that he's got to squeeze past. Yeah, I mean, how do you walk past Capernaum along the lake without going into town? Yeah, very hard. But he passes by, and he's avoiding the cities. Why? Because he's just pronounced woes upon them. He feeds. We've got lots of stories here from the Exodus. He feeds how many people? 5,000 and 4,000. And the disciples, when they see people hungry, they make what suggestion? Send them where? Into the towns and the villages. And Jesus has just left them. He's pronounced this woe. Remember, this is a wicked and evil generation. He's saying, now is the time to leave. So Exodus, out we come, gentlemen and ladies. Yeah, but now is not the time to be hanging around in these cities. Yeah. This section is Exodus imagery. And in fact, we then end up with another Exodus imagery, chapter 17. Jesus goes up a mountain. Yeah, and on the top of the mountain, he is transfigured. We see his glory. And he's there with Moses and Elijah. And then we've got I hope you can recognize who these are. Yeah. And the elders, Moses and Elijah, the law and the prophets. And then we've also got a Scottish weather front coming in. Yes. A cloud hanging over everything. And what does this remind us of? This reminds us of Exodus 24. Okay, where Moses went up. Now, while Moses was at the top of the mountain, what was happening at the bottom of the mountain with Moses? Golden calf incident. Jesus comes down the mountain and he finds, we've got the epileptic boy. Okay, and do you remember how he describes what's going on? He looks at them and the disciples couldn't help that young boy. And Jesus turns and he says, this wicked and evil generation. So while we've got this revelation of glory at the top, we've got faithlessness at the bottom. Just as with Moses on the top of the mountain and the golden calf at the bottom. Okay. And then we finally come to the last one. So this is really Exodus imagery, conquest, Exodus. And then Matthew 28 is really conquest. Okay, and it's go, teach, and be with you. Okay, Jesus tells them, go. He tells them, teach them all things that I have commanded you. And he tells them, I will be with you till the end of the age. Now, where have you heard that in the Old Testament? You've heard it in Joshua chapter 1. where Yahweh says to Joshua, he says, oh, my helper, my healer, that's the Greek word used in the Septuagint, my healer has died, Moses. Now, get up and go over. So there's the command to go. And when you go, I want you to teach Israel everything that I've commanded them. And do not fear. Be courageous. Yes, the word is manly. Yeah, be manly. Yeah, and I will be with you always. So we've got these three allusions. But there it was in Joshua. Where are they conquering? Israel. But here, with the Gospel Commission, where are we conquering? The world. So really what we've done, we've gone through, let's try and conquer Israel. And then we find, not working. We find it reaches crisis point. And now, instead of looking into Israel, he's taken them up to Galilee. And from Galilee, you can see the nations. And he's saying, now, what do I want you to do? Instead of conquering the place behind you, I want you to go forth and to conquer it. Ascend my kingship out. Now, there's two very important declarations. Okay, and how am I going to draw this? So we've got it. You're going to have to forgive me. But the declaration at the baptism of Jesus. Yeah, you need to know this off by heart. Yeah. So what were the words at the baptism of Jesus? This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. What was the declaration of the voice at the Transfiguration? This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Listen to him. Has to repeat it. So these are the two. This is the literary structure. We've got woes here. Yeah, Matthew 23. That's 23. So it's really, we've got this declaration. He tries to help them. Woes. He leaves. Another declaration. End up with woes. They kill him. And now we're rebooting the project, but towards the nations. And this is where this is my beloved Son. Where is this taken from? It's from Psalm 2. Let's just go back and read it. Let's go to Psalm 2. Okay, and this psalm was read at the coronation of Israel's kings. Okay, so why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? Do they do this in the gospel? They do. Now, if you read in Acts 4, they actually apply this text to the death of Jesus. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds asunder and cast their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens, I like this. So you can believe in conspiracy theories, you know that? Why do the nations conspire? So they are conspiring. But this is how you respond to them. Yeah? The Lord who sits in the heavens, he giggles. He says, how on earth do they think they're going to take charge when I'm the one who's in charge? Yeah, so let not your heart be troubled. The Lord has them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, and here we have it, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. So there you have Yahweh declaring who his king is. So, this is Jesus' identity. He is a king. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Now, where does this come from? Isaiah 42, verse 1. Let's nip over to Isaiah 42. This really is the heart of the gospel. Yeah. Isaiah. And I think once we've done this, we will stop just for questions. So there we have verse 1. Now, this is a paraphrase. It's paraphrased by the Father's voice. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring justice, forth justice to the nations. So here we have the chosen one in whom he's well pleased, in whom he delights. And what is he called there? He's called a servant. And this is the thing, is all the way through the gospel, the kingship of Jesus is always mixed with servanthood. Now, he is the servant of Isaiah, blended with the messianic king. Yep, so whenever you see him, you think when he's there with being beaten by the soldiers, when he's arrested, what do they put on him? A crown. They put on a robe. Red robe. They put in his hands a scepter. So there you have the kingship, but is he suffering? Absolutely. When he's crucified, he's there, hung on a cross, and what are the words above him? King of the Jews. We could follow that. Here is my apology to you, is that what I'm sharing with you this weekend is really looking at this. Really, what I would like to do is to spend time telling you about this. But in a way, Jesus does all of these. And all of this is really the story of repent. Why? For the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's Jesus the King coming back to his nation. And his nation, he's trying to turn it around. We'll see that it's a nation that's idolatrous, adulterous. It's turned its back on God. And what he does, he models this for his followers. He expects his followers to be this. Yeah? And he's hoping that, really, as I've done my studies, what I've seen is that these roles are roles in which can turn a nation to the kingship of Jesus. That's their purpose. Yeah. So when we get to the Gospel Commission, he is, all authority has been given me under heaven and earth. It's a quote from Daniel 7, where the Son of Man has been given authority over the nations. And our job as we go from Galilee is to conquer the nations for King Jesus. That's the narrative of the Gospels. Now, we will find that the nations can either welcome us gladly, or they can shut their doors, or they can persecute us. Those three responses. And each of those three responses carries a very specific divine response. And we will see that tomorrow. So that's probably maybe a bit overwhelming, but we've got something on the board, and hopefully you've got a reasonable idea. I don't think we've got time. I mean, what you can do, you can enroll, maybe you could audit at the seminary, my Matthew exegesis class. Then we go through chapter by chapter, but we don't really have time to do that in one weekend. But what I've tried to do there is give you an overview, and then we will thematically, starting tomorrow, go through prophet, disciple, righteous person, wise men, scribes. They all have a particular role in turning a nation around to Jesus. So this is not about getting you to heaven. This is about establishing the kingship of Jesus over his creation. That's the purpose, is spreading his lordship. Yeah. Okay, any questions? Any comments?
Thinking of the nation of Scotland, are we approaching the nation or the people in the nation?
That we don't know. So the word is ethne. We get the word ethnic. Yeah. Or as we say further south, ethnic. Yeah. But ethne. So the debate is this talking about, when we think of an ethnic group, we think of, okay, you know, she is like my wife. She is from Tigray, and she is not Oromo, and she's definitely not Amharic. Now, we think of genetics. But in the ancient world, your ethne really probably was related to where you were born and your city. So if you just think, I am a Roman, what are you emphasizing when you claim to be a Roman? From Rome. What is Rome? It's not an empire, it's a city. I am an Athenian. From Athens. Yeah, so people in the ancient world, primarily their identity was shaped by the locality where they lived. Yeah. Which is why when you're reading Revelation, it's a story about cities, Jerusalem and Babylon. Yeah, it fits perfectly in the ancient world as to how they constructed identity. Yeah. So that is a debate. And our problem is that we come along with 19th century definitions of nation states, and we impose it onto the text. Yeah. Because really, the nation state as we know is really an 18th, 19th century construct. So if you think of Europe, you know, 200 years ago, was Germany a country? No, it was little city states. Yeah. Italy wasn't a country, a state, it was little principalities. And your local identity was far more important. Here is one of the things that I don't know whether I'll get time to emphasize it, but we will see, and as Westerners, so this is where we have to sort of take our Western hats off and put an ancient hat on, is that your group identity is more than your important than your individual identity in the Gospel of Matthew. We will be judged. And that at that point, you'll get your answer, Steve. So it'll be Scotland. And maybe the archangel will put a little twang into it. Scotland. Yeah, so you know who you are. Come forth. Yes, and now Scotland is going to be judged. Yeah, and then England. We're judged as nations. Now, by and large, we don't give this a second thought. Yeah, but I will show you how. Yeah. When we all end up before judgment throne, Matthew 25, we all come in our groups. Okay, we'll see it tomorrow. Yeah, that it's towns, Capernaum, Bethsaida. Yeah. Good grief. Been waiting to say that for about 3 days. So it's a hard one. And our problem is really trying to get back into the ancient world. So maybe nation, maybe ethnic, maybe a bit of both. Let's always sit on the fence on these things.
I'm just kind of thinking aloud a little bit here. There's been about 400 years between the end of the ancient land and this one, this part of the gospel. Is there any significance in the fact, I mean, they probably had lost track of a lot of the truth by that time. 400 years without a prophet, a priest, and all that. Now, before that, when they were in captivity in Egypt, there were 400 years there too. So they also had lost their true identity. And they struggled when they came out. Do you think the people of Christ Day, they were really, really struggling? That yes, they were an evil generation. Was there an excuse for that? They had struggled for 400 years as their ancestors had struggled for the same amount of time centuries before.
Yeah. So in the Old Testament, we've got the law. And then, did Israel keep the law? No. So the Lord sent along which group to tell them, turn back to the law? The prophets. Okay. Did they listen to the prophets? They were sent into exile. But then, when they came back from exile, who was the guy who spiritually reformed Israel?
When they came back from
I heard it. Ezra. Okay. Ezra. Now, he was a priest, but he was also a scribe. He knew the law. And what he is, and I've done some slides. I've been preparing basically everything this week. I've got some slides, but I don't know whether we'll have time. But he is presented as a new Moses figure. Everything that Moses does, Ezekiel does. And is it on? Are we on Ezra and Nehemiah? So maybe I need to save this for my for my Sabbath school group back in America. But what he represents is a shift away from the prophets and back to the law. Okay? So now when you read the Gospels, they know what the law is. Yeah. They know the law.
Had it been corrupted during 400 years,
Well, their problem is that they know the law, but their problem is deeper. Is that their hearts. They want to get around it. They actually construct other laws in order to get around. Jesus says, you make the law of God nothing through your traditions. So the problem is not a lack of knowledge. And this is what you find in most serious texts, is that when they're looking at spiritual problems, ignorance is not usually our problem. Usually our problem is something deeper. It's where our heart chooses a way other than the way of the Lord. And we will see that when we look at scribes. These guys are the guys who are meant to keep God's law underpinning society. So what I want you to do, I want you to think of these terms not as church terms. I realize there's three other points I need to... Can I have two more minutes?
How can I say no to you?
Okay. So, political theology. It's a whole area burgeoning at the moment. So, just think, this is a political theology. It's not how to run your church, it's how to run your nation. And I want you to think of it in those terms. So, we know Christendom. Christendom was essentially the Catholic nation, where the church runs the whole show. Okay, it's a theocracy. This is a theocracy. What happens to theocracies? Are they always good?
No.
They get corrupted. But essentially, what we're being asked to do is to establish a theocracy. But we know that theocracies can turn negative. And then we've got the magisterial reformation with Luther and Calvin. And then we've got the radical reformation. And these guys, the church and the state, work closely together. The Lutheran church is a state church, and the princes run the show. The problem is that gradually the church moved away, if you look at Germany, and it became very, very... It isolated itself and was isolated from ruling, influencing the rulers. And Lutheran spirituality essentially became internal piety. And the problem was that when the state went bad, the church was so far off in its own little world that it wasn't there to correct the state. That's World War II, World War I. And our Adventist church was part of that. There's a book by Johannes Hartlepp. He's the principal of Friedensau, or he was when he wrote the book. And he, I was sharing with Mike this week, he gives the figures. In World War II, there were 30,000 German and Austrian Seventh-day Adventists. So 30,000, how many of them are likely to be men? Of the 30,000? Maybe half? So we go to 15. Okay. How many are likely to be under 18 and over 60? Maybe half of those? So maybe we're down to 7.5. Guess how many were serving in the German military? 5,000. Plus, 500 are being killed, 500 are being injured. So it's almost, when you look at the Seventh-day Adventist Church, it's almost as if every single army age man was serving in the German army in World War II, in the Adventist Church. Almost every single. And here, well, others resisted. There were two who said no, and they were shot. Okay. Whereas other churches said no. The Jehovah's Witnesses said no, and they were just killed. Okay. But the problem had been that the church had moved away from the state. Here, the Radical Reformation, that of which the Anabaptists and the Adventists are, we move really quite far away from the state. And our danger is that we end up completely isolated. And so, as I've been doing my studies on this, I'm always asking, what is the model? What I see is that none of these models are perfect. All of them can have a problem. Okay? I think the only time we will see the true kingdom is when Jesus comes again. In the meantime, we need to look at how we assess the churches, as in this building, the institution of the church and its relation to the state. We need to understand that what this narrative is. If you are someone who's been brought up in Radical Reformation, where the church is over here and the state is over here, every time you read the disciple-student term, you're going to assume it's talking about what? Church life. It's a church thing. But if you read it like this and you see disciple, then suddenly it becomes a nation thing. It's not just a church thing, but it's got far bigger implications. And so this is really what I'm trying to do, is to imagine what is the role of the church in wider society. That's my goal with this. Yeah, because if we don't know what our role is in wider society, we've got nothing to aim for. Yeah. And I suspect that the bigger the vision, the more motivating it's going to be. I suspect it'll be. So that's why I'm doing that. You know, over in the US, the politics is just divided, it's bitter, it's whatever. And what is our role as the church? Now, we're asking that question. Yeah, it's to promote the kingdom. Well, what is the kingdom? Is it isolated? No. You will find that a lot of this is blurring the boundaries that we've normally thought of as the church over here and the state over here. Yeah? Wise men. Joseph. Daniel. Solomon, Nehemiah, Ezra. What were they all doing? Leading their nation. Yeah. Okay, that's a good point to stop.
Thank you very much indeed, Cedric.